This book is like your embarrassing uncle.
Like, listen to him long enough to find out what he's getting to, but you have to get through all that stuff in between.
Yeah, you could view it's more tolerable if you've had quite a few drinks along with them, but if you give them too many drinks, then they're intolerable. It's tolerable up to a point. This crosses a line, absolutely. So it's too, is it too sexist? Okay, so I think there's a few questions there. So what makes something a classic, obviously? Who gets to decide what is a classic?
Welcome to Life,
Death,
Sci-Fi.
And if you enjoy this podcast, please give us a review on iTunes and subscribe on Stitcher, Spotify, or iTunes, or whatever galaxy you deem your podcast from.
And as always, there may be, probably will be, spoilers.
Strangers in a Strange Land by Robert Heinlein, who also wrote Starship Troopers.
Right. Now, already you're saying Heinlein. In my mind, I was pronouncing it Heinlein.
Oh, which is the right pronunciation. If I'm an author and I wrote all these books, I would want my name pronounced correctly.
Yeah. What I didn't know, I suppose like you never have enough time for like research and stuff. You know what I didn't do, which I tend to do. I don't know why I didn't do with him. I usually go to YouTube and try to listen to a few interviews and things. And I didn't even cross my mind with him. But that would have helped. Now we're going to find that out real quick. I never trust some of those pronunciation things. Guest of honor, Robert Heinlein. Mid-American, I don't know that. This is from the Mid-American Con.
I have now just about
can you hear
the easiest
that?
Task in the world.
Yeah.
That's him talking, but it's
the
not
task
his.
Oh, you need to get that guy who introduced him.
Favorite people, who has been with us at CBS for several of these missions now. And Arthur, what do you think we ought to do next? What would you like to see, the space station or?
The greatest event in all the history of the human race.
Found Robert Heinlein.
Robert Heinlein.
You know, Walter, in thinking back,
that's Walter Cronkite. And
done so many years.
You got it?
Walter Cronkite.
Yeah. About
Robert Heinlein.
And let's bring them in. Bill Stout and Robert Heinlein.
Robert Heinlein.
You know, Walter, in thinking back to what the...
So that could be our intro. Robert Heinlein, what's the... I like those podcasts that start off, too. They start off with a little bit of conversation and then move into the...
I think we have to do that. That's kind of what... Almost the definition of a podcast.
Yeah.
Like, the audience has to get warmed up. You have to warm up the audience to get into what you're doing.
So we're looking for a little, like a moment of levity or a bit of something profound. So maybe this is a moment of levity where it's, we realize as we just two sentences in that we were not sure how to.
How do you say this?
I had it. So it's Robert. What? Now I'm already forgetting it. What is it? Robert?
Heinlein.
About and done
Heinlein.
So many years before the landing of Apollo 11.
Heinlein, well, it's going to be hard for me. I got to look that up earlier. Shoot. Heinlein, I'm going to be saying this wrong the whole time.
All right.
Instead of shoot, I've got to say Hell's Bells, like our buddy Jabal. Yeah. Not my buddy. Yeah. Some of the language is pretty fascinating to go back to. I wonder if it reads true to the 50s, right? Hell's Bells.
I definitely wanted to talk about that. I think that's important because let me ask you this. On a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being the hardest book you've ever had to slog through to finish, 5 is the page turner, and I can't wait to get to the next one. Where was this book?
I think the word slog came to mind. Wonder where this slog came from. Now, yeah, I mean, it was a real struggle, I think.
And now I'm going to ask you, why was it a real struggle?
Yeah, and I guess that's the question. So I read it on a plane. the first half I read on a plane, and then it was really a long gap before I came back finally and just powered through. So that was a struggle to kind of power through. I found myself interested at first, and I think I struggled with the Jabal harsh moments. So when he was dominating the pages, I found it less interesting. So I wasn't as interested in the politics of it all. Where there was like a lot of that, like a lot when he was, you know, the moments with the Secretary General or setting that up. I was much more interested in the pages where it was the man from Mars and when it was about him. And I wasn't interested in the larger maybe question. I guess I'm interested in the questions that were being asked, but I guess these kind of sacred cows that Heinlein, am I saying that right? Heinlein?
Yes, Heinlein.
Heinlein asked. I'm interested in those questions, but I didn't love those moments where it's seemingly harsh. What do we call him? Harsh or Jabal?
I didn't love
that. So that was a struggle for me. I think
you didn't love that the politics part of it and all of that. The parts that really slowed me down were living in the Me Too generation and him say things like, I marked these in my Kindle, but after about 20 of these pretty misogynistic, the definition of misogynistic comments, I stopped marking them because there were so many. But one of them really struck me is he actually said that, in the case of rape, it's always a little bit of the woman's fault.
Yeah, Jill said, I typed all these up. You want, let me read them.
How many were there?
I didn't think I got every single one, but let me read off a little list okay. here. And then we can see if we want to do anything with that. So this is it. This is what I wrote down as I was reading. And I think, in order. Don't worry your head, honey child. Little one, honey lamb, have another drink. No, you're real bright for a female. Jill looked round-eyed. Don't talk while I'm orating. Sorry, pretty fools. Gotta run, chicks. That's the babe. None of that, you little slut. Harshaw, watching his three secretaries splash in the pool. There's blonde, red-headed, dark, pleasantly plump, too deliciously slender. A woman who can't cook is a waste of skin. Playmates. Harsha says, took a dim view of males being reared by females. The word front, that obviously is, are you the kind of female who comes unstuck when she's needed? A girl's name ending in A, that always suggests a C cup. Flat-chested bunch, aren't you? It's a growing closer if there are young girls and pretty, such as Jill. Which one of you wenches? Halfway there. He was not the infantile type, interested solely in the size of mammary glands. That's just terrible. He wouldn't like it if Jill bitches. Quiet girl, or I'll paddle you. Trotter, my wife's just giving me she's making a face, as she should. Trot around, that's a good girl. Places, girls, we should never have put shoes on them. Back to the kitchen, woman. But let's drink to the girls, Sven. What's that toast to the flickas? And I can't remember what that follows. Something follows that. Food, girls, put it where we can reach it and maintain a respectful silence. And there's a section where he reduces around page 200, where he reduces the women to A, B, C, and D when he's talking about them. What'll it be for the little lady? Cola, milk for your rosy cheeks, or a real happy day drink with the big folks? You're acting like a broody hen. Ouch, women should not be muscular. High time. That boy was salted. He knew she liked to shop. He forced her to, and this is Mike. He knew she liked, after he joins the circus, he knew she liked to shop. He forced her to indulge her weakness by sending her never any outfit, which he sensed no longer delighted her. That's another question, maybe like to Marcus. Why does Mike, as someone who's enlightened, shift into, he almost takes on like Harshaw's voice? If God didn't want women to be looked at, he would have made them ugly. And then Mike says at one point to Jill, time to leave, pick a dress and get your purse. Okay, if a healthy woman liked, I'm almost done. Okay, if a healthy woman liked to be looked at, then it follows as the night, the day that healthy men should like to look. This is where, this is around toward page 300, it's about three quarters of the way through. Jill says, this is Jill, 9 times out of 10, if a girl gets raped, it's partly her fault.
Yeah, yeah. That I had to put the book down at that point, and it was so in my face. So,
well, just a few more here.
Okay.
Think four more. How would you like to coax her into bed? She would be as lively as a seal and as slippery. Then, in all the years I've studied this subject, the subject being women, trying to trace the meanderings of their twisty little minds, the only thing I've learned is that when a gal is gonna, she's gonna. All a man can do is cooperate with the inevitable, which kind of runs to another motif or idea throughout for me, where this is that moment where Jabal visits their, I guess, the cult or the religion, yeah, of all, the religion of all worlds. And yeah, and one of, I can't remember which one of the younger girls convinces him to sleep with her. And there's a lot of this kind of ongoing thing of sort of creepy-ish father figure. There's a Hugh Hefner kind of quality. This old man, is this like science fiction writer's creepy dream? Or is it? Anyway, he's got a couple more here. Don and Jill, this idea that Don and Jill are made, oh, maybe it's Don that he sleeps with, that Don and Jill are made to look the same in the end. I thought that was really strange. And then he's got pipe down and close your mouth. This is not a time when women have the vote. What happens when clothing isn't necessary and women aren't engrossed in dressing up? They'll never, and then in parentheses, it says they'll never lose interest entirely. That's on 379. Parentheses there is quite strange because why parentheses? Whose voice is that? Right? Is that the author? Usually, a lot of times, the parentheses would be the author's interjection of some thought, whereas if the author is in cahoots with the reader, which kind of speaks to the audience. So I don't know. There's a bunch of things there. I don't know. It's a lot. I knew it was a lot to read out, but I just kind of wanted to put that out there because it's when you see that all together, it's just brutal, right? It's
yeah. And I would, one of the things that I would say is that we're looking for classics, the best science fiction. I'm not sure, because of this, I'm not sure that really fits the definition. But put this in perspective. This was written in a time when there was an attitude of free love. There was contraception for the first time. The pill came out. There wasn't any general knowledge of AIDS or any, you know, kind of disease that, you know, would spread like that. And if you look back at the videos of the time that this book was written, there was that kind of free love, music in the park, that kind of thing was all over. Is this a story written out of that time, or is this just this guy's misogyny that is coming through in his work?
So this is, I think the question is it misogynistic? So clearly, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely misogynistic. And I think I'm hyper aware of, I was thinking about this beforehand too, we're a couple of men talking about this. So I guess we can do that. That's something. So clearly misogynistic. I think the things that you're, when you get into those, I think there's two different things, threads there. One is like the misogyny of it. And the other is some of the other, like the free love, polyamory, but this polyamorous idea. I think it was very in that, because it won, so it wins the Hugo Award, right?
Yeah.
And I think it was Time. I feel like my notes are organized. Was it, look at a couple of things here. So this was, put this here somewhere. There's a few things that were pretty, yeah, original for it. So terrible reviews from like the New York Times and a few other places. The New York Times called it a disastrous mishmash of science fiction, laborious humor, dreary social satire, and cheap eroticism. Yeah, it characterized it as puerile and ludicrous. It says, when a nonstop orgy is combined with a lot of preposterous chatter, it becomes unendurable, an affront to the patience and intelligence of readers. But
so why does it end up on?
I totally agree with that personally. That was my reading of it. But it was a Hugo Award, and it went, and it was, and I, and just recently, I think in 2000, gosh, where is that? I want to say in around 2000, it was named as, I've got to find that, by the, what is it? Oh, shoot. Lost that. By this really reputable, like it was named by, I think it was like the Congressional Library as one of the like top 100 books that like everybody should read.
A real, how does this happen?
Well, I think it was those ideas that it suggested. I think questioning the way it questioned religion and norms of sex, that was considered avant-garde, or it was pushing the boundaries of what was acceptable. So it was praised for that.
I found the religious parts interesting because the bigness, the show of it is science fiction. It was futuristic because those kinds of things have become real. If they weren't real, then they are now. The huge auditoriums, the music, the show of the big reveal, and the way that in the book paralleled the Carney experience and how people looked at the marks and how to bring them in. That was pretty interesting.
Yeah,
I did only a little research on this, but I found it stunning that this book started that religion. So there is a religion that follows the same principles as the book.
Yeah, I saw that too. That was amazing. In fact, I read on one website that, now I'm forgetting his name, the guy that started Scientology.
Yeah? Oh, no, really?
There's a myth. Forget the guys. Do you remember the guy's name? I know if you said it.
Casey? Not that guy.
Hang on a second. I can find it real quick. Because it's worth finding. It's a...
Healthy Breakfast.
So mental note to my notes. Better order here. Oh, I can't find it. Is it Hubbard or something? Hubbard?
Oh, yeah. I know Hubbard. Yeah.
Yeah. And so anyway, the myth is that they were in a bar and they made a bet as to who could start a religion sooner than last. And then they were it's documented they were friends, but nobody knows if this was a real bet that they had or not. And so the other guy, the one guy goes on to found Scientology, and then Heinlein does end up founding a religion that still exists, Church of the All World, Ka or whatever, which still exists, Church of All Worlds, which still I saw it still exists today, which is pretty wild.
Very wild, yeah.
I thought he really hit on a key idea in the future, that it's all about happiness. So the idea that the church is all about happiness and the self, like thou art God. So I think those two things are super, super accurate in the sense that an emerging, a seeming, something that acts like a religion or almost a cult at times, our desire for kind of mindless pleasure seeking. I'll take a phrase from Fahrenheit 541, and also the focus on the self, with self-help and how to better yourself. It's all through your own self and not necessarily others. Not as a sort of organized religion necessarily, although you could say people who feel so passionately about MacBooks, or if you're a PC or a Mac person, or maybe if you're really into World of Warcraft or whatever it might be, like that becomes your religion in that sense, or maybe it's gambling or something. So I think he definitely captures that. And then also the circus like qualities of it. I think, yeah, the circus idea is pretty fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
I guess that's a form of worship, right? If you spend all your time, I used to work with somebody, I had this colleague in the past. I don't know how much we want to be teachers in this as a side note, but I had this colleague who used to, I'm trying to think of when she would do that. It might've been with, at the same time, she was teaching Fahrenheit. It was amongst a dystopian unit, or you know, maybe it was kind of an end of the year type thing. And she had this, I can't figure out what to search to find it. I really want this book. And it's like a picture book, and it's at post-apocalypse, and it's these aliens are actually, you know what it is? I want to say it's, this is weird, I might be mixing this up, two different books, but I want to say it's like sheep have overrun the world, and it's like these sheep that are finding the remnants of human civilization, or maybe I'm misremembering, it's like aliens. And so they're looking, all they have, are like these rooms of things that are like being uncovered.
Oh, I know this book.
Yeah, and all the rooms have...
Motel. It's a motel.
It's called the Motel?
Yep. Mysteries.
Okay, that doesn't sound... I really can't remember, though, but they find all these rooms where everything faces the TV screen. Yeah, they don't know what the TV is, but they assume it must have been something that they worshipped.
Yeah.
Because all the rooms face
anyway.
Yeah. Is it Motel? Oh, man, I got a...
Motel of Mysteries.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I remember some of the toilet bowl. I'm seeing an image with that. They were kind of trying to figure out... Okay, I got to look into... Yeah, look at that. Interesting. Yeah, so I think Heinlein really... He nails that. Okay, let me ask you this, because I thought, as you were saying that before, and it relates to this thread, would you recommend this?
I've read this book three times. The last time was really difficult. The first time I read it was, I don't know, maybe 35 years ago. And I read it for the science fiction of it. It's got flying cars. It's got travel to Mars. It has like a one world government. It has some science fiction things to it, but not a lot. It's mostly about the mind-body kind of connection and religion. As I read it more, I liked it less. And especially in the Me Too generation, a lot less. Because I can't believe how unaware I was when I first read this. I didn't see those references at all. I'm sorry to admit.
We're very woke now.
I don't know if I look woke, but I'm woke.
I was trying to think of a title with woke, but woke. So I think woke. That's not going to...
The woke pod.
Woke, the pod, well, woke. Woke sci-fi.
Oh. No.
It's got a nice ring to it, but I don't think I can make that the focus. That would be an interesting angle to go back and read. I guess you're always doing that, though. You're always reading these through different lenses. Which, speaking of which, I thought that would be a good approach to a possible structure, too, to put on a few lenses. Like, what would a feminist say?
Yeah.
You can look at this.
we can bring in special guests. Okay, before we go too far, I really want to ask you this question. Is this book a classic, or is it just a historical reference, a reference to, you know, what it was like to write a book in that time? Is it, or is it an oddity, or is it just a trash? Should we just put it in the trash bin of literature and leave it? Is it a classic? Some of those organizations that give awards to books think it's a classic, but as you said with the New York Times, they didn't like it at all.
Right.
Where are you on this?
Yeah, that's a tough question.
Is it,
so I guess,
a classic, historical reference, an oddity, or trash bin? Where are you going to put it?
Classic. I feel like oddity. Is oddity a, what is that? What's the right word for that?
Okay, an oddity is you walk into a store and it has all of these weird things in it that you can buy, like dolls' heads or medical devices that 50 years ago, or some kind of weird game or puzzle, you know.
Like some kind of, yeah, some kind of oddity. Kitsch, like a kitsch, like it's horrible. Like a, what do they call those things? Like a black velvet Elvis painting,
yes,
or something. Yeah. Well, I mean, to me, this is like this book is like your embarrassing uncle.
Like, listen to him long enough to find out what he's getting to, but you have to get through all that stuff in between.
Yeah. You'd almost have to, it's more tolerable if you've had quite a few drinks along with them, but if you give them too many drinks, then they're intolerable. Like it's tolerable up to a point. This crosses a line, absolutely. So is it too sexist? Okay. So I think there's a few questions there. So what makes something a classic, obviously? And then I think there's also a question of who gets to decide what is a classic, right?
Who gets to decide what a classic is, just time itself. Does this work have enough weight to last all of that time?
Yeah. I guess that's part of my would you recommend it question is there enough in this that's worthwhile to outweigh all the sexism?
For me? You're asking me?
Yeah, I think that's the question, yeah. Is there enough? Because that's what a classic has to be, something that you would read. Okay, I'll take, now I'm going out of sci-fi here. Maybe, I don't know if that's something we want to do, but I'm trying to think of an example with sci-fi. But I was going to use Antigone as an example, right? Sophocles, Antigone, right? Some Greek play that to me stands the test of time. But let's try to stay in the world of sci-fi. So let's take, I would say, 1984, certainly it's also a prediction of a future. It's also, it's very similar in the sense like it's post, there's been some kind of World War III. It deals with sex as a revolutionary act. There's some similar elements there, but certainly things that Orwell didn't get. We're talking about predicting. So I would say this with sci-fi, I don't think they have to get the science predictions to be sci-fi, but I would say in order for something to be a classic, it has to continue to resonate in terms of the larger questions that it asks and whether or not the questions are still relevant.
Yeah, I think larger questions
to being a classic.
Huh?
I said I'm talking myself into it being a classic.
Oh, I see.
But I don't think I want it to be a classic because I don't think I would recommend it.
You're talking to the guy who recommended it to you, and now I regret that.
It was on that list, right?
See, the thing is, there have been a lot of other stories written in this with the same kind of first contact theme, that this boy grew up on a different, totally alien culture and carries with him or her those things that make him or her alien.
Right.
So I think there's enough science fiction out there with that theme in it.
Did you read that it was his wife's idea and it was based on the Jungle Book?
Oh, no, I did not.
Yeah. So he's talked about that. Yeah, so it was based on, he said it was a conversation with his wife who was, and they were talking about, I guess he was strongly influenced by, and again, I'm going to mispronounce this maybe. Is it Rudyard or Rudyard Kipling?
Yeah.
Okay. Is it Rudyard or Rudyard?
I say Rudyard.
Okay. Kipling, it had a strong influence. There's a few other of his works. I can't remember off the top of my head, but he had a big influence on Heinlein, his style and ideas. But this, yes, he said it based on conversations with wife about you should do a Jungle Book-like idea, but instead of being raised in the jungle, he's raised by aliens.
Yeah, I totally see that.
I thought that was kind of cool idea. In that sense, it's a bit classic in this idea of not only first contact, but this idea of an alien or being raised by others.
So
that's I grew.
So you're saying it's the classic?
That's an archetype.
Mm-hmm. Yes, one of my favorites.
I think the idea is a great idea, excellent idea. I love for a novel. I think it's brilliant.
Yeah, but for me, it just doesn't hold up. I don't think this is going to last the test of time. I think for me, it's a good historical reference because these are the kinds of things, as it was written, you will notice that these references to females in the book aren't the norm now. But if you have to do that, then that's taking away from the story itself, I think. It can't hold up by itself. It has to be explained.
Yeah, we should come back to the story itself. I think I made a note at some point, talk about plot a little bit and the character of Valentine Michael Smith a bit. Let's come back to that. But so stay with the classic thing. Okay, here's my thought as you're saying that. Because I was ready. I thought I was going to have a hard time talking about this because it was so hard to read because of the misogyny.
Yes.
I would not recommend it. And I find myself, and I think not exactly playing devil's advocate, but wanting to argue for it still being a classic in some way. But as you're saying this, because I guess the question is, if something has racist elements, which is another question here, because it doesn't deal with race hardly at all, which is, I think, a huge oversight. The idea is no race. How would an alien or somebody who's raised outside amongst a totally homogenous culture not want to explore that at all when he arrives on Earth? So that's a big oversight, a big plot hole, right? Or like a big gap for me. But it's because it's clearly sexist. Okay, so what about Star Trek? The old Star Trek, wouldn't we say that's classic?
Yeah.
And yet very chauvinistic and sexist in the same kind of way.
Now you're poking at one of my icons here.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Hmm. Okay, I'm going to have to think on that because I guess that's totally true.
I mean, it's a little hard to see it in writing. And I think maybe we could say that he, which is interesting because he had to fight. I mean, I read that he had to fight to include a lot of things that the publishers wanted to take out. So it was banned, I think, because of the probably, I'm guessing, probably words like slut and that kind of thing. And so he had to fight to include a lot of that in there, which is maybe the true voice of some people. I mean, still today, there's people like that out there. So that's a truth, even though it's not a truth that we want to necessarily read, or we wouldn't talk like that. But there are people who do. He fights to keep that in. Whereas, say, Star Trek, if it wasn't censored at all, couldn't you see Captain Kirk probably would have sounded a lot like Jabal Harshaw? And then we've got women who are totally objectified in their dress and all that. And we would still say that's classic because of, I think what makes it partly classic is we love the ideas that are were addressed in sci-fi at the time as a way of getting around some censorship and stuff and talking about challenging ideas. Like a lot of sci-fi at the time was getting into Twilight Zone and stuff, getting into questions about race or thing or ideas that were controversial, but doing it because it was through these alien worlds, they were able to talk about things that were a bit taboo.
I don't have my research marked on this, but I think Heinlein was one of those authors who wrote to make a living. And one of the things I heard was, or I read, was that he was told to put some of those things in because it sells books, it sold books. So I think we have to do a little more research to find out how those things got in there. You say he fought to keep them in there, and I read the publishers told him to put that stuff in there.
Oh, yeah, I didn't see that he was told to put things in. There's definitely, posthumously, his wife published the unabridged version, which is my question for you, because you were reading it, I think, with your Kindle. And there's a, I think, I want to say it had 60,000. This is definitely right. What I'm saying is definitely right. The number may not be right. I think it was, I want to say 60,000 more words in it. And you can find some side-by-side comparisons. It's not, it's some of it, some things, like it definitely changes meaning. I don't think it changes a lot of the salacious stuff, I think was pretty much all there. But there's some things where there's a line, I think, where he says, the greatest danger to man is man himself. The book, the version I read, it is the greatest danger to man, man himself. And the unabridged version Heinlein wrote is the greatest danger to man in space, man himself, which is like totally different meaning.
Yeah.
But I don't think the salacious stuff was, if anything, that was, I think, was cut out based on what I read.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't think he was encouraged to put that in. He was fighting to keep everything controversial in there. He'd said that they wanted to, there's some letters that he'd written where they were trying to cut out the stuff that referenced religion and sex. And those were like, he's on record of saying those were not, he didn't use the phrase, I think, sacred cows. I just read that somewhere, but those were the things he was trying to question those norms in this book. And I think in that sense, to me, you know, as a classic, I think that stands the test of time. I think we're still in a questioning those ideas about what would make us transcend ourselves or how do we progress. I guess this is arguing for progress through questioning ideas about religion and sex. And in that sense, I think it questions things. But at the same time, it's doing that. There's like some lines that are homophobic, right?
Oh, well, yes.
And lines that are really sexist. So he misses the mark on that. But the overall like questions, those questions stand the test of time. Does that make?
Yes. Yes.
And he was pretty adamant that if you're reading this book for answers, like you're totally, like he didn't really like the idea that there was, I think, a religion based off of this. He felt like it was not a book for answers, but a book for questions, he says, which I think good. I don't find answers in this.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So could something be a classic, but we wouldn't recommend it?
There are lots of classics that I will never read. I could say, yeah, it's a classic, but I don't recommend it. No, I don't know. Do I want to put a classic label on something that I don't agree with? That a lot of the things I don't agree with? I find some parts pretty interesting, like the mind-body connection, how if you are so tuned, grew up in an alien culture, and you could tone your body or do the things that Michael did, I think is futuristic and interesting.
Yeah.
Like, he never needed a haircut because he could grow his hair and keep it at the same length. He could tone his body. He could move things with his mind. All of those things. Could they be possible? Is that science fiction? I don't know.
I think, right. I think that's an interesting idea, and one that, I guess, in terms of evolution, certainly we've progressed in that sense. Even we've barely touched on the mind. I mean, the mind is an unexplored, like this inner exploration is an interesting sci-fi idea, right? Is there more to explore within ourselves than there's like inner exploration versus outer, you know, going into space versus going within ourselves? I think that's sci-fi, right?
The other part of, and you just said it about evolution, is pretty interesting. The survival aspect of a Martian is kicked out of the nest at birth, and if 1 out of 10 survive and then come back in, and then they're forever in the nest. Where, by contrast, at least in the story, it talked about on Earth, we're protected in the nest at birth, but then have to meet with survival for the rest of our lives. So there's a little different alien perspective there. And I thought that was pretty good science fiction.
Yeah, no, I thought that was... Well, to me, that reminded me of some kind of... I don't know, Nazi Germany or some kind of this idea that is there a superior race? To me, it was almost advocating for the idea there's some superior, you could breed out certain groups and end up with a superior race, which I found really unnerving. And I thought that the book seemed to suggest, Heinlein's not saying there's answers, but at least if we look at, we call him Mike, we look at Michael or Smith as a heroic figure, then are his ideas those to be valued? He's suggesting like the aliens get this and we're not quite ready for that yet. And then we're having spoilers in this podcast, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Spoiler alert. That he would then in the end sacrifice himself because humans aren't quite ready to transcend into the Martian-like figures that understand that it's all about eliminating the weaker beings in order to become stronger as a group. But it's not about the self. It's less more about the group than the individual self. Kind of doesn't really value the individual in that.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time with that, with the ending. I thought it was... I don't know what to say about that.
So what would you, should we talk a bit about Valentine Michael Smith as a character?
Sure.
So yeah. do you, he's obviously portrayed as a Christ-like figure.
I don't think there's any other way to look at it, really.
Did that work for you?
That's a good question.
Okay, let me ask this question. Did you find him likable?
A good question. It was a hard read because I didn't, there were many things I did not find likable. No, I guess not. I didn't find him likable. And part of that was that the Carney reference. I don't like to be looked at as a mark.
Mm.
And you're right, because of the different levels of their nest kind of religion, they were weeding out the people who could and could not understand what was going on. So what is that called, eugenics? No, I don't like that.
Yeah, it's like a scary it's a bit of an AI quality to it, this scary, powerful, I guess in this case a machine that would weed out or eliminate anything that's threatening, right? I guess the sacrifice at the end is, I don't know what the point of that was. So at the end, he gives up his own body. So it's like the body of communion, right? The body of Christ, obviously. But the point of that is he does that in order to, what do we gain from that, or what does he gain? He does that because he feels, so I guess the redeemable quality in him is he has this moment of realization. This is that's tragedy, right? It's this anagnorisis, like this moment of realization where he understands that he's actually a spy sent from the Martians to probably create a race or a world in which is more habitable for these Martians. Or
okay,
they would have
to, I didn't see that coming, but I like that.
And so he sacrifices, that's redeemable, sacrifices himself because he doesn't want to continue to be the conduit that kind of reports or sets up that world. He realizes, in that sense, he's almost like some AI that would self-destruct, that would then have, that's the human coming out in him. So he would sacrifice himself for the sake of humanity, because humans would become less human through this process that he
sees. Or maybe not survive at all. The planet would just disappear.
Yeah, yeah. So I think there's an element here of what makes us human. That was a question, like, there's an exploration of humanity in this text as to what makes us human.
So you're saying sacrifice makes us human?
That it's our ability to, what's our
survival,
affections, our fallibility, isn't our imperfections that make us human?
Did he sacrifice himself so that others could survive? Is it a survival thing?
I don't know if is a willingness to sacrifice yourself. That seems almost more Martian. Do you think humans would sacrifice themselves? I guess we do sacrifice ourselves for others, though, right? Not all humans, but some humans. He doesn't seem to understand. I guess that's a bit of an aside, but like, he doesn't seem to understand satire, humor. He takes everything literally. There's a willingness to see our own faults, to laugh at ourselves, to find humor in sadness or the inevitable. That makes us human. Tragedy makes us human.
I found it interesting that when he finally found the ability to laugh, it was to laugh at
The zoo,
the negative things. And I, you know, and I thought, oh, is that really true?
Yeah, that was really creepy. He starts laughing at the zoo.
Yeah. And then expanded that out to humans. And okay, I see that. I don't want to be like that.
Yeah, is that part? Did you feel like, I guess there was a bit of what rubbed me the wrong way too here, in addition to the chauvinistic lines. I felt like, I'm bringing Heinlein in, I got the feeling that the writer or the thinker behind it felt like he was superior to others. There was a superior kind of tone running throughout, whether it was through Jabal Harshaw and then later through Michael Smith, when he moves from innocence, once he becomes experienced, it seems like he's, like you said, I felt like as a reader, I'm the mark. I don't get it. Or I'm the monkey in the zoo. Or I'm in the Matrix and I don't get it. I'm not woke.
Yeah. That's a good, really good point.
Which is not a fun thing as a reader. Like, you're not in on it. Right. So it wasn't like dramatic irony in that sense. I think it would have liked this better if there was like that kind of dramatic irony running throughout, where it's not. I think I wanted this book to be about a Martian arriving on Earth, and it was actually human and discovering the human race, but I was like in on it throughout.
And there's a lot more to explore as a Martian on Earth than just what we were revealed in this story. I thought it was pretty, pretty like we were locked in a room and we could only, we were only told what was out there through a couple characters. How do we close our podcast? Do we say something like, oh, this belongs on the top 100 best science fiction books of all time? Yes or no? Is that what we do? Or do we just say, oh, I like the book, girl? How do you want to end it?
I thought about, yeah, I don't know if you could do
thumbs to the side, thumbs down.
Yeah, gosh, I don't have mixed feelings about that. It'd be cool to have some sort of listicle kind of thing. I don't know if you've listened to, those are tend to be more episodic, but like the, some Game of Thrones podcast, like the Binge Mode. You ever listen to that?
No.
But there's more like an episode. They're like, who won the episode kind of thing.
Okay.
So there could be like, could there be a list of questions like this? I thought about whether or not at some point you could have some, maybe these end up prompting a lot more conversation. And obviously, these it's going to be hard to have shorter conversations here, but faster paced, and we can work on that. Because I actually have like way more to talk about, but we've been talking for a couple hours, and so I don't feel like I'm quite there. But we've got into it some depth and talked about some interesting things. But I thought, could we do like is there a text to text, and maybe in that sense it's. If you like this one text, then maybe you would like this. If you thought ahead, like what is this similar to? You've touched on that with First Contact. I guess part of me is kind of going, is it First Contact though? Because it's not an actual alien, but it's alien. But is it a fish out of water kind of thing? There are a few maybe kind of types of genres where if you like this sci-fi book, you might like this one. No, it's tough because I think now that I'm talking about, I've talked about it with you, I'm glad I read it. But I wouldn't recommend it. They're going to make a series or a movie. I'm not sure who's doing it. I read that somewhere. It to me, maybe this is one where I would say, watch the movie. Don't read the book. Assuming they revise or reinterpret some of the, I assume they'll make it less, if they're making it today, they're not going to make it chauvinistic. Yeah.
Be interesting to see the differences if you've read the book. I don't know if I just say, oh, go out and watch this movie. Like Altered Carbon, I thought was, the book was great and the movie was, or the series was wonderful.
See, I didn't read the book, which I'm regretting. And I think it's on that list. I want to read it.
I thought you did.
No, because you, I remember you read it, and I think this is terrible because I judged it by its cover, and it was a part of that book club, and I didn't.
Oh, yeah.
I thought it was like a YA thing, which is stupid because I like Hunger Games is YA, and I like that. There's definitely The Giver I like. There's some YA novels that I like, but I just didn't, and after watching the series, I really want to read it. It's a super fascinating idea.
Maybe that's the next one we read.
Yeah, I was gonna suggest this is a series of short stories of your life and other stories. And this is, I think this is one of the longer short stories in here. It was the basis for the movie Arrival.
Oh.
And he's a real, like a super successful sci-fi writer today. I mean, if you haven't heard of Ted Chiang, Google him. Like, there's some really cool stuff he's been associated with. And he's done a few of his short stories were on the LeVar Burton Reads podcast, and I really enjoyed them. So if you're down with that, just because I don't have a lot of my shipment hasn't arrived here. I don't have a lot of books, but short stories, well, that's a different thing. I guess it's not on that list, though, huh? I'm already suggesting something that's not on the list.
Oh, no.
I know.
I know. I think that's okay.
All right.
Yeah, my battery's low. And
yeah, you got to go.
Really successful.